Good afternoon. As Jean mentioned, my name is Michelle Mahoney, and I work within Superfund in the Technology Innovation and Field Services Division at our EPA headquarters. Thank you all for joining us today. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI, is hosting these webinars, and this is part of a quarterly webinar series about the reuse of Superfund sites. The webinar shares stories of sites and projects that are part of SRI, and we also provide guidance and tools to support the appropriate reuse of Superfund sites. But today, I'm happy that we're going to be discussing the benefits of ecological revitalization, illustrated by various projects across the country, and we're going to talk about how EPA actively supports and encourages these types of projects when appropriate. I'm very excited that I'll be joined by Ed Maureen, Bruce Pluta, Jeff Field, and Damon Frizzell, all from EPA. And then we also have Mary Byrne from the Pollinator Partnership. So for today's webinar, I'm just going to give you a very brief introduction here on reuse and why reuse is a priority at EPA. I'm also going to share with you why SRI, the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, encourages beneficial and sustainable use, including ecological reuse, which we're going to talk about today. I'm going to talk a little bit about ecological revitalization and some technical considerations. And then we'll have our featured presenters. Ed Maureen is going to share a case study about the ecological revitalization efforts at the Bunker Hill site. And then we'll have Bruce Pluta discuss the importance of considering native plants and pollinator habitats. And then we also have Jeff Field, who's going to talk about the Chemical Commodities Incorporated site, which has an impressive, very impressive example of how site reuse has turned into a pollinator habitat. And then we'll have Mary Byrne discuss the Pollinator Partnership and the many resources that they provide. And then we have Damon Frizzell, who's going to talk about some work that EPA's Region 7 office is doing related to a pollinator work group. And our presenters are very excited to be here and talk about their work. So feel free to ask questions throughout today's session, as Jean mentioned, by using that Q&A pod in the bottom right-hand corner of the webinar platform that you see in front of you. So I'm going to take a few moments and just talk about how SRI supports site reuse. You know, EPA's primary mission is to protect human health and the environment. Superfund cleanups have also played an instrumental role in returning contaminated sites to productive use. SRI works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities, and we also integrate appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. We do all this work at a national level, developing policies, tools, and performance measures that help support reuse activities. And then we also work at the regional level, supporting site-specific projects and sharing lessons learned. On this slide, I'll just mention we have a picture of some test plots for an American chestnut seedling planting that was done at the Palmerton Zinc site in Palmerton, Pennsylvania. EPA is very supportive of site reuse. We think of regarding the consideration of reuse in the remedial process, it's kind of evolved over time. In recent years, reuse has become an integral part of what the agency's strategic plans and goals are stating. Integrating reuse into cleanup helps inform the cleanup decisions at a site to ensure the remedy matches the intended end use of the property. It can help protect remedies in the long term through stewardship and maintenance of the property and implementation of the appropriate institutional controls. It can also open the door for local economic revitalization by attracting businesses, jobs, and clientele to the area. And it also provides important social benefits such as ecological and recreational resources and community gathering spaces. In addition to this, a reuse of contaminated properties promotes sustainable, resilient, and livable communities. And we do this by advancing smart growth and redevelopment of contaminated properties. Reuse also helps with preserving land by using infill properties and previously developed properties instead of greenfields. There sometimes is a misconception that redevelopment and reuse cannot happen at a site until the remedial action is complete. But I want to make sure that it's understood that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during Superfund cleanup. So if you're looking at reuse while developing your remedial action objectives for the site, or when selecting a remedy, or during remedy implementation, or even during the long-term operation and maintenance of the remedy, reuse can help inform that cleanup process in a way that ensures that we get a long-term protectiveness of the site. And just quickly, I wanted to point out the photos we see here on the top left. This is our Milltown Reservoir sediment site in western Montana. And then we have innovative cleanup and recreational reuse at the Lexington County landfill area near Columbia, South Carolina. We have a recycling facility that's located at a site in Jacksonville, Arkansas called the Vertax site. And then we have a picture in the bottom right of the community planting for ecological reuse at the chemical commodity site in Olathe, Kansas. And we'll hear Jeff Field talk more about that today. So there's a lot of benefits of reuse. When it's considered early in the cleanup process, a site can be in a better position to apply the reuse tools that SRI has for returning the site to productive use. SRI has found that site reuse provides a variety of economic, environmental, and social benefits. We've seen commercial reuse of sites and how they support new jobs and add income to the community. We've also seen increased public revenue and property values at and around sites where reuse has happened. And with vested interest and long-term stewardship of the property, reuse also leads to a better protection of human health and makes the site less likely to be a target for vandalism or illegal dumping. And we can also provide sites with recreational opportunities and restore valuable wetlands and natural habitats. And you'll see some examples of that today in our presentation. There's a lot of different ways that we can reuse Superfund sites. There's no one-size-fits-all. We'd like to look at what's appropriate for the community that we're working in. And so today, we're just going to talk about how ecological revitalization has become part of the reuse for some site cleanups. In the picture here on the slide, we have photos from a site in Port Salerno, Florida, the Solitron microwave site. And this just shows how prior reuse of a site that was abandoned, it was an eyesore to the local community, is now an industrial park that provides jobs and businesses to the local community. So the process of ecological revitalization of a property leads to an ecological reuse outcome. And EPA actively supports and encourages ecological revitalization when it's appropriate on sites under its cleanup programs. Superfund cleanups protect and restore the environment and protect human public health. But before the natural systems at Superfund sites can support parks, wildlife habitat, farmland, forests, they need to be restored to a functional and sustainable use. So ecological revitalization can be a cost-effective way to achieve this. It can also provide some benefits to the community, such as increasing property values, tax revenues, tourism, facilitating healthy lifestyles. It can have impacts on reducing flood control and stormwater management costs, and it can improve local air and water quality. And pictured on this slide is the Atlas Tax Superfund site that's in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. This was restored as part of the remedial process. And on the it was the Northwest 58th Street landfill. So now I'm going to go into my introductory ecological revitalization and reuse of contaminated sites presentation. And pull that up here. Give me a second. Great, I think the slides have loaded up. So I'm just going to talk very briefly, more specifically about ecological revitalization and reuse of contaminated sites, which is part of our Superfund reuse. I'm going to have a little presentation overview here and talk a little bit about what it is. I'm going to present some very brief case studies because you're going to get some more in-depth examples from our other presenters, and make some relationships to sustainability and reuse, present an example of some gardening activities at a previous Superfund site, and then just share with you where you can get technical assistance and more resources on this topic. So the picture you see here is actually a document that EPA published a few years ago on all the that talks about the technical and policy considerations related to ecological revitalization. And so I just wanted to give a definition for ecological revitalization. It's the returning land from a contaminated state that one can to one that can support a functioning and sustainable habitat. A lot of times we see the term ecological revitalization and ecological reuse used interchangeably. And we like to make just a subtle distinction between these terms that, you know, there is a process of ecological revitalization of a property that leads to an ecological reuse outcome. And as I mentioned, this is part of EPA's way to create innovative redevelopment of Superfund sites. So Superfund sites protect and restore the, Superfund cleanups protect and restore the environment and protect human health. Ecological revitalization can be an innovative and it can be cost-effective land reuse to provide both direct and indirect benefits, some that you see listed here on this slide, such as improving soil health, support vegetation, sequestering carbon, contributing to green infrastructure, and providing ecosystem services. Ecological revitalization has also been translated into dollars and cents for communities by increasing nearby property values, tax revenues, tourism, healthy lifestyles, and improving the local air and water quality. And again, we have some pictures here. Again, there's a picture of the restored Atlas Tax Superfund site in Massachusetts, and the bottom is a revegetated cap on one of the operable units at the California Gulch site in Leadville, Colorado. Yeah, so I mentioned that ecological revitalization can provide a number of indirect benefits to the community, and these are referred to as ecosystem services. So what exactly are ecosystem services? And I thought I would just list a couple of some of the examples here. You know, one way is to describe ecosystem services, that there are ways that the natural environment can function to directly benefit people. Some of the, like, pollinating food crops, natural decomposition of waste and energy are just some examples of these services. There can also be some material benefits, such as food and timber, as well as intangible benefits as education and recreation. So I mentioned that this can be a cost-effective way of cleaning up our sites and getting them into reuse. And that just, this slide just shows some examples of some data that we collected at a few sites. For the California Gulch site, you can see that there was about $2.5 million saved, a 50% cost savings to some of the remedial alternatives of taking removal and liming and reseeding. At the College Park landfill, we saw a 54% cost savings. And some of the alternatives there that were looked at were doing a RCRA D landfill cover versus the soil amendments vegetated cap that was done. At Palmerton, there's been a tremendous amount of savings, almost up to 96% cost savings. And this is the site is very large, and that was compared to excavation and removal of material as opposed to using soil amendments as part of the remediation and revegetation. And then at Sharon Steel, they were looking at a biosolids cap, about 59 to 84% cost savings, and this data was collected when the site was just being evaluated, and some of the alternative remedial options were looking at long-term monitoring, removal and excavation, and doing some armoring. So there was significant cost savings from looking at just doing a biosolids cap. So during the Superfund remedial process, ecological revitalization can work towards reducing contaminant bioavailability in some cases, improve the groundwater recharge, control the landfill leachate, and stabilize soil and hillsides. And ultimately, as we're going to be talking about, is lead to an ecological land reuse. I just want to talk about some of the factors that determine whether and how ecological revitalization can be supported at a specific property. I want to make clear that standards of protection are not lowered for a property that will be reused in this way, nor does the reuse reduce any effectiveness of the cleanup measure. Risk assessment is used as a tool to assess the remedy performance, and if the cleanup means the acceptable residual risk, we can discuss this as a successful remedy. And most ecological revitalization efforts are not considered enhancements and can be incorporated into the property cleanup plans. And the costs can be justified if the revitalization is required because of the environmental stressors or adverse impacts caused by the cleanup. And some of the things to consider are varied interests, objectives, and requirements of all the stakeholders. And because, you know, and to have a successful revitalization effort, you want to have to be well-facilitated, open communication among the stakeholders. And some of the pictures we see here are from the Milltown Reservoir Superfund site, which is a mining site, generated mining and milling waste. EPA worked with the local communities and federal and state and tribal partners on a coordinated approach to link remediation, restoration, and redevelopment of this reservoir. And the communities developed a reuse plan that called for, you know, they wanted the creation of a state park, trails, river access, wildlife habitat, and interpretive areas so they could celebrate their history and heritage. And so today, the remediation removed more than 3 million tons of contaminated sediments, and the complete restoration of this channel has been achieved. And then I wanted to just present to you some steps to take when planning and carrying out ecological revitalization. It's important to know what your pre-disturbance conditions are and referencing those and use in your planning of your ecological revitalization work. Looking at a property inventory to provide a baseline ecological inventory of the biodiversity at your site. You would want to look at your species composition, your vegetative communities, and this can help you guide in your ecological revitalization planning. And sometimes appropriately designed ecological revitalization can become self-sustaining and require little or no maintenance after the initial establishment. However, sometimes O&M will be required and depend on the type of cleanup as well as the ecological revitalization that was performed at the site. And some of the typical O&M can include inspection, sampling, analysis, routine maintenance, small repairs, and any reporting that's needed. So I mentioned in the first slide that we have a document that talks about all of these considerations, and I pulled out one of the tables that can be found in that document. All of these resources are available in our links to more resources section in the to the middle right of your Adobe Connect screen. And so I want to pull out this table because it presents some issues that can occur when waste is left in place at a cleanup property and how some of these issues could affect ecological revitalization and some potential approaches to mitigate these issues. One thing that I want to point out is just timing. The longer planning is delayed, the greater the possibility that fewer reuse options will be available. So we like to encourage site managers to begin revitalization planning as early as possible and developing it as part of their property cleanup if it's feasible to do that. You can bring in some restoration ecologists to determine the proper season to plant native grasses, shrubs, trees, and that will just help you in increasing your chances of success. All these Superfund sites, they just have some remarkable stories. The cleanup, as part of the cleanup and restoration process, we can learn a lot about environmental science, ecology, and how natural systems work. And then there's also the site history that supports the community heritage. So one thing about site reuse is, you know, we like to recognize and incorporate these stories as part of the educational opportunities to kind of transform these sites into classrooms. And there's a lot of examples of how Superfund sites, you know, have created education areas and programs by putting in signage along boardwalks and trails and interactive teaching just to try to preserve some of the history related to the work that's been done at these sites and some of the culture that the communities are interested in retaining. So I'm going to quickly go through a couple case studies. I wanted to present the Greensgrove Farm that is on the former Boyle galvanizing property. And this is a one-acre plot in Philadelphia where they're doing some urban gardening and agriculture. The backstory is that this site was contaminated with lead, arsenic, zinc, and cadmium in the soil. EPA conducted a removal action around 1995 to address these contaminants. They excavated the contaminated soil and backfilled with clean soil. And what we have now is something called Greensgo Farm, which is founded by Mary Seton Corboy, who acquired the property in 1998. And she was looking to start an urban farm to grow lettuce to supply restaurants in Philadelphia. And she selected this site because it was a large piece of property that was close to her customers. So she relied on EPA's risk assessment and coordinated with environmental specialists at Penn State. Trucked in additional clean soil, constructed greenhouses, grows crops hydroponically, and builds raised garden beds. This is just a great example of a site, you know, that got put into a reuse that the community really wanted and needed. And there's a picture here. They have community-supported agriculture pickups. Another site I just wanted to talk about a little bit was the Palmerton Superfund site in Pennsylvania. It's a former zinc smelting operation during the late 1800s. Heavy metals were contaminated over a large area. This is of the Blue Mountain. The Appalachian Trail goes through here. There was a lot of environmental damage from this heavy metal deposition that prevented plant growth across about 3,000 acres. So as part of the remedy in this site revegetation is being accomplished through applying a customized blend of native seeds and site-specific soil amendments. And they tried several methods of application, changing formulas, and eventually transitioned to using some aircraft to apply the soil amendment and seed mixture at the site. As I mentioned, part of the area has been revegetated along the top of this Blue Mountain where the Appalachian Trail runs through. And one thing I'll mention about Palmerton, we also have a video on our website where you could learn more about some of the work that was done there. Another site is the California Gulch site in Leadville, Colorado. This is a former mining site where tailings were washed along the Arkansas River. There was low soil pH, elevated metals concentrations. Lime was used to amend the soil pH, and biosolids were applied to the tailings. And there was also a wide range of performance measure tests looking at earthworm, fish, and small mammals to determine, you know, that the revitalized habitat was not creating any attractive nuisance. There were some studies done and results showing that the bioavailability of the heavy metals in the site were dramatically reduced by treating them with soil amendments, and that the wildlife exposure was within acceptable limits. And I'll just mention that this is now an award-winning trout stream in Colorado. So the Vermont Asbestos Group, this is a site where we provide some technical expertise to conduct greenhouse studies to determine the optimal mix of soil amendments for the site remediation and vegetation. And we've provided recommendations for seed mixtures to revegetate the site, conducted some bench scale studies, performed some soil bioavailability studies, and hoping that this data can be used in the future planning of revegetating this site, because this is early on in the process, but just trying to get the data and information out there and making decisions on how to revegetate a site like this. And another thing that we try to do to get out some of this information on how to do this on Superfund sites is through communication and outreach. We present information at conferences. We do the web-based seminars, such as the one that you're attending today, conduct some training courses. We document our site information through videos, case studies, site reports, and fact sheets, all of which you can find on our website, which is available in the resources section. We also have a database of sites that have put into ecological revitalization with contacts of people to you know, who have some lessons learned and how they overcame some obstacles and to achieve success at their site, so there's people you can contact. And then I'll just mention that here's the website I keep referring to, fluin.org/ecotools. You can find links to all the information I talked about today. And we've recently added an area on ecosystem services and are developing a pollinator area. So with that, Office is going to talk about some work that he's done at the Bunker Hill site.
Hi, thanks, Michelle.
Sure.
As Michelle noted, I'm with the Region 10 office, and I'm going to present to you a case study that's actually documented in a tech memo that's currently on the cluin.org/eco website. And in that tech memo, there's a description of the case study that I will present in another case study, both involving the Bunker Hill Superfund site. So today's presentation is going to focus on the creation of waterfowl feeding habitat in what we refer to as the lower basin of the Coeur d'Alene River Basin, which was highly contaminated by historic mining practices. I'll give you some site background here as we move forward and help you get oriented on the site and the practices that occurred at the site. So first off, I'll give you a brief site orientation and a brief site history. It is a Superfund site. It's called the Bunker Hill Mining and Metallurgical Complex Superfund site. There are three operable units. Operable unit one and two both are focused on what we refer to as the Bunker Hill box, and I'll show you that on a map in a second. And operable unit three is pertaining to basically everything outside of the Bunker Hill box where contamination has come to lie. And then there was an upper basin rod amendment that was issued in August 2012 that pertains to, as the name states, upper basin. And I will orient you to that in just a second on a map as well. So here's a basin geography in a bit of a cartoon map, but I think the important thing to display is that we're talking about a site that basically spans the entire panhandle of Idaho, so wedged between the states of Montana and Washington, and it actually extends into the state of Washington on the Spokane River. So zooming in a little bit here is the Coeur d'Alene Basin. To the east of the city of Coeur d'Alene, which is about 300 miles east of the city of Seattle, just to kind of help you understand the geography here. So when we talk about the upper basin, we're in essence talking about this area along the South Fork of the Coeur d'Alene River, extending up into Canyon Creek, a 9 mile, and for all practical purposes, extending to the Montana border. This is the Montana border, this wiggly ridge. It's actually a ridge top. And then what we see is that the contaminants continue to be transported and were transported over the better part of a century by the South Fork of the Coeur d'Alene River and into the main stem of the Coeur d'Alene River, which begins here. This is what we refer to as the lower basin. So essentially west of the Bunker Hill box is the lower basin where the North Fork and the South Fork come together. There were mining activities that occurred on the North Fork, but they pale in comparison to the famed Coeur d'Alene mining district on the South Fork. This is Lake Coeur d'Alene here, so obviously a big recipient of the sediments and the contaminants that are transported by the Coeur d'Alene River. And that flows out into the Spokane River, which flows into Washington. And the green shaded area actually delineates the study area for the RIFS. And we do find contamination, at least in small pockets and much smaller concentrations, but they are certainly found in the Spokane River. Lake Coeur d'Alene is actually dammed up. There's a dam here at the outlet. It's actually closer to the city of Post Falls that controls lake level. And as you might imagine, the lake is a pretty significant repository for sediments. So moving along into the practices that occurred at this site, historic mining practices, like many sites, there were no tailings impoundments. The site was actually discovered in the 1880s. And as you might imagine, discharge was wherever you could get rid of the waste and get it out of your way as quickly as possible. Note the steep hillsides here, and this is really predominant in this mining district. The green highlighted thing here is actually a sluice line that's conveying tailings from this Morning Mine and Mill site into the South Fork of the Coeur d'Alene River. So using my arrow, here's the sluice line, this green unit. This is the South Fork of the Coeur d'Alene River, and as you note, it's opaque. It's completely chock full of sediments and obviously very turbid. These are tails on both sides of the river, and obviously the river is doing what it needs to do, and that's get rid of sediments. So every time that river boils up, it's depositing sediments, which in this case are mine tailings, and depositing them on the floodplains as quickly as possible. But as this occurred over the better part of a century, you might imagine that over 100 million tons of metals were discharged into the system, and now those metals are widely distributed. It's estimated that it was 2.4 billion pounds of lead that were discharged, and it's dispersed over 10,000 of acres. So slide six is a bit busy, but just a couple of things that kind of help point out the productivity of the site. On the left-hand vertical axis, you have ore in megatons. That's metric tons. And on the right-hand vertical axis, you have metals. That's actually metals produced, in essence, by the district, also in megatons. And what you will see in the blue bar graph is the actual ore production by the district, and you can see that it follows World War One and on and into World War Two, so big booms and busts. And then lead is a very strong correlation with that activity. That's the red line. Zinc, slower to be a commodity, was not a commodity in the first 20 or 30 years of production, which meant that it was directly discharged in the environment and was not captured at all. But even then, after capture was beginning, during these jig tailings days, recovery was very poor. Sometimes only 30 to 50% of the metals that were being recovered, such as lead, were being captured, and the rest was going out the disposal pipe, if you will. So the Bunker Hill box was a major player in this. So this is near the town of Kellogg. And these photos show a lead smelter on the left-hand side. You can see the smelter there. And on the right-hand side is zinc plant, which is where these plumes of smoke are coming up in the background of the lead smelter photo. It was a major industrial complex. It was cranking out the Bunker Hill mine is located adjacent to this plant. You also had milling activities here and, of course, smelting of both lead and zinc and other metals. And then, of course, the plant was also smelting all of the product that was being produced by the other neighboring mines in the district, and there were many. So there's quite a history here. Contaminants were prevalent in the air, especially so in this upper right-hand photo, where you're seeing the lead plant being operated without a baghouse. And as a result, you also had highly contaminated soil and water pathways. Some of the highest blood leads ever measured in the world were detected here in the nearby towns of Kellogg and other neighboring communities. And the hillsides that you see in the zinc plant here were denuded as well as these hillsides behind the lead smelter, which you can see in this photo in the lower left are actually pretty well devoid of vegetation. That's another story. It's actually also captured in the tech memo I referred to earlier, but we won't be getting into that in any depth today. We're going to focus on that lower basin that I mentioned earlier in the map slide, and this photo actually shows just the complex of wetlands and lakes in the lower basin. So finding my arrow again, this is the Coeur d'Alene River running right down here, and then you can see there's a number of lakes and sloughs, as well as herbaceous and wooded wetlands, all running along this Coeur d'Alene River, which is shuttling all these heavy metals slowly but surely downhill and down gradient to Lake Coeur d'Alene and beyond. And this slide shows maybe the greatest challenge in dealing with the lower basin. It's a very flat gradient. You can see the river channel running here, if you're following my green arrow, and it continues to wind on down. But in this photo shot in 2008, following a fairly frequent flood event, that you can see the floodwaters well outside of the channel, and all of the same color, highly turbid, And, of course, these floodwaters are containing the heavy metals that we're concerned about, lead, arsenic, cadmium, and zinc. And these lead levels are typically 3,000 to 5,000 parts per million in any flood event, and they certainly were proven to be that in that particular event. So just another aerial orientation here. I want to help you understand this Agda wetland, or the Schlepps field is what we refer to it as, is right here. And this is just another shot of this lower basin, the Coeur d'Alene River running along here. You can see these lakes. And then you can also see some of these wetlands. And we'll get more into the site specifics here in a second. But talking about lead, and that's, you know, lead is very happy in its particulate form. What we see in this district with, you know, based on the sampling activity and the kriging activity, you can see that lead is well above 1,800 pretty much throughout this thing, and when you combine that down to 530 parts per million, which is identified as a threshold for protection of waterfowl, that pretty much the entire lower basin, floodplain itself, bed, banks, channel, and Coeur d'Alene Lake are all above that 530 threshold. So we'll talk about some revitalization activities on this wetland. One of the key components to any activity on this kind of a project is having a great partnership and a large number of partners that are active and willing participants. So you can't get this done on private property without a willing partner. And in this case, the private landowner, Mike Schlepp, was very happy to work with EPA and these other participants to give up some of his property rights to allow this easement to go forward. He still lives at the parcel or adjacent to the parcel. He's an overseer, and he works very hard at maintaining it and making sure it doesn't have any major issues. But we couldn't do this without Fish and Wildlife Service, without Ducks Unlimited in this case. They were a very interested party. The Coeur d'Alene Tribe has a significant interest in this site and in this area, the whole Coeur d'Alene Basin. These were their historic grounds, and they're a major partner here, along with Idaho Department of Environmental Quality. We also worked with other natural resource trustees, the state of Idaho, and DEQ is one of those, U.S. Forest Service, the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. The Fish and Wildlife is also a natural resource trustee in this area, and, of course, the Coeur d'Alene Tribe is a natural resource trustee as well. The Corps of Engineers actually administered the contracting activity on this site, so they're a major player as well. So what are we seeking to do here? Well, the objective was to create clean waterfowl feeding habitat. This photo on the left-hand side, these are tundra swans. They migrate through on their spring migration north. They mate up here and on head-on north. Unfortunately, they die in high numbers in the Coeur d'Alene Basin, and that's a reality because of the high lead levels. And you know, part of their diet consists of ingesting high concentrations of sediments. And unfortunately, when they're doing that in this basin, as they're chasing tubers, they're also ingesting high lead levels, which is toxic to their neurosystem. So obviously we want to create places where they can frequent on their way north and reduce these mortalities. So we had to do a number of things. These soils were high in lead. They were well above the 530 action level. And of course, so the construction had to actually take some surface soils and bury them deep. And of course, you have to do that in a time of year when the soils will allow you to get in there with heavy construction equipment and you can stay productive and make this happen. But we got it to a level where well below what the swans would be feeding at and other waterfowl so that we can create that safe feeding waterfowl habitat. So a little bit about the state of the site here. Here's just another aerial photo, and you can see the east field here, what we refer to as the east field, and the west field. Mr. Schlepp's house kind of sits on this little peninsula right here. Here's the Coeur d'Alene River running by, and this is the Trail of the Coeur d'Alene. This was another project that was part of CERCLA. That was converting the Union Pacific Railroad rail line into a trail corridor. But the trail provides a embankment of safety here, keeping floodwaters from the river out of this site. And that's a key component in a site that still can carry so many such a magnitude of contamination so that we don't encounter issues with recontamination. So jumping to the data here, what we found, U.S. Fish and Wildlife monitors waterfowl in the Coeur d'Alene Basin. Not all of it is accessible from vehicle, but they are out there on a weekly basis monitoring waterfowl activity, and they look at tundra swans, the lighter blue, as well as mallard ducks, Canada geese, northern pintail, and monitor other activity as well. So these slides, this one and the following slide, both focus on the Schlepp's field activities. This slide you're looking at is the West field. And what you see here is a prominent jump in activity, particularly swan activity, in 2014 and 2015. And we see that in both the West field and the East field. And that's very good. We want to see swans. We also want to see other waterfowl using these sites. And we're certainly seeing that, but we've seen historically, even since the completion of construction on the West Field, which was in 2011, reasonable waterfowl usage. But we want to build fidelity, and we also want to see increased use by swans. And you don't see the swans using the West Field much here, except 2014 and 2015. We saw a similar dynamic with the East Field, which is the slide that's in front of you now. And again, those tundra swans, obviously high usage in 2014, 2015, March and February of those years. Good usage on the East Field of other species. But what we find is these particular last couple of years, we had high water events that basically rendered the other wetlands and lakes in the lower basin undesirable to the swans. The water was deeper than their feeding range, and so they frequented the Schlepp Field. Which is good news. We've built it, and they have come, and they're using it. We want to continue to see that kind of usage. But the results of all that is that we also saw a significant decrease in observed waterfowl mortality. When Fish and Wildlife is doing their monitoring, they're doing bird counts of mortals. And what they found is that the typically you'll see about 73 observed swans every year. So that's swans that have died in the Coeur d'Alene Basin. But in last year, in 2014, they only observed one swan that died. And in 2015, a little bit unique year, they've seen about half of what they typically see, about 30 observed. Again, flooding was on our side, but it was a flash event this year, and once the waters receded, they dispersed out into the many other acres and wetlands. We estimate about 18,000 acres of wetlands that are contaminated in the lower basin, and they do have some site fidelity, though, so those are one of the challenges we see. But certainly we recognize that flooding is the first order of control on where the swans feed and also frolic. So just to jump to lessons learned here, got to keep moving. On this particular site, the Schlepp's fields, those are tundra swans here, and shot in that photos from 2015. Good usage in this particular instant. What we've seen at this site, and I think one of the major lessons learned is having all the parties at the technical table helps ensure a smooth transition from remediation to restoration. EPA performed the remediation, but we have handed that off to the Natural Resource Trustees. In particular, Fish and Wildlife has taken a lead on the restoration activities. They continue to perform restoration activities at the site with plantings and such. Working in the wetland soils is challenging. You have, in this particular site, a very shallow groundwater, which makes it very difficult to operate equipment, get things set up, stabilize things, and just a very short construction season. So. Just allowing, I think, for a reasonable schedule and those challenges is certainly helpful. River levels controlled by the downstream dam create interesting challenges. The Lake Coeur d'Alene is operated for recreation, and so from Memorial Day to Labor Day, it is operated at the optimum elevation for homeowners and recreationalists. And they also operate for power purposes. But it is a pinch point as well, so getting water through the system in a flood event can be challenging. And that is something we can seize in at this particular site because we can control water levels. Placing the soils, the contaminated soils, in areas that are secure is always a challenge. And as Michelle noted, building repositories has its costs. We built actually armored overflow areas that allowed the soil to be used as a bank stabilization mass, and also protected those areas so that they would not be problematic in the future. One of the things that the project highlighted and made us aware of is that the nearby highway culverts were actually pinch points, and they were causing problems for this site and other sites, the neighboring properties. And as a result of our communications with them, with the highway district, they have actually rectified that situation and put in properly sized culverts. So, sometimes there's an upside, and sometimes you can actually work through that with other entities to resolve those issues. You know, I think one of the things that we can't that we've learned is the things we can't control take longer than expected. An example is there was a decision to shift to a portable electric pump to help control water levels in the West Field. And that particular shift resulted in the need for high voltage power, which resulted in the need to have the local power company provide that, the power outlet and the substation. And, of course, that took a long time to make happen. There was a long queue of activity that particular summer, and so it cost us almost a complete year to get that issue resolved. That's just a result, that's just the reality of being in construction season. But you don't always anticipate that things will have as a significant event as they do, or a significant impact as they do, and you have to just stay cognizant of the challenges out there. Completing all of the agreements in advance is a key issue. We had an agreement with a party to be the easement holder. This is an easement, and unfortunately 2008 occurred, the economy imploded, and they were no longer a willing party to be that easement holder, and that's an issue that we're still working to resolve to this day, but I think we're on a good path to get it resolved. But if it had been signed off as originally planned, I will tell you that we wouldn't be talking about that as a lesson learned right now. So that is avoidable. Since we can optimize the water levels for waterfowl, the site has seen extraordinary use when the flooding impacts other areas. And I think that's just a key finding and something that we continue to learn from on this particular site. But it does have great positive benefits at this site. We just need to figure out how we can create more site fidelity. And one of the things that we're seeing and hearing, we're working with Fish and Wildlife, and they're planning on transplanting some wapitos or water potatoes to the site this year, and that's something that's a favorite food source for tundra swans, so hopefully that'll help with site fidelity. One of the things we also found out was that early vegetation success was not good in the West Field, and soil chemistry that could have been useful if we'd have collected that during remediation or pre-remediation, and maybe just the remediation itself could have been slightly modified to create conditions that were more favorable. The issue has been rectified, but I think it could have been seen a speedier resolution if we'd had more information up front or early on. I will say that we, given the magnitude of this site and the magnitude of the contamination in the Coeur d'Alene Basin and the tremendous waterfowl mortality that is observed on almost an annual basis, we will continue to look for these kind of remediation techniques as others. As you might imagine, it's never easy and it's never quick, but it does lend itself well, and this site does lend itself well for performing this type of remediation in the future. And that's the end of the presentation for today.
Great. Thank you, Ed. We did get a number of questions come in. I think maybe we'll pause for maybe a minute or so to answer some questions before we move on to the next presentation. We have a couple people who were asking about what armoring is, and you had mentioned armored overflow, and I'd mentioned armoring in my presentation. Do you want to kind of talk maybe just a little bit about what armored overflow is?
Sure. So, I guess armoring in and of itself means using some sort of material and applying engineering principles to it that would provide a level of protection. And so in this case, we're talking about an overflow channel, if you will, that allow flows to move from the wetland into an adjacent channel. And if you're armoring that outlet, you're going to want to make sure that you do it with the material that's appropriately sized or has the appropriate strength properties so that it can handle the velocities of flow at that particular channel, if you will.
Okay.
So riprap is an example of armoring, but there are other engineering materials that are softer that might be applicable as well. Vegetation and geofabrics are always a good alternative if it has the engineering properties you need, if it's strong enough in essence for the velocities you might encounter.
Right. Good. Thank you for clarifying that. I'll ask one more question. You'd mentioned that some of the surface soils were buried deep, and one person was curious about how burying that contaminated soil, if that has any effect on the groundwater.
Yeah, so good question. In this case, these particular soils that we're concerned about are very high in lead, and in this district, you know, these lead sulfide ores are not prone to going into solution. So I wouldn't expect that it would actually hamper the groundwater or have a significant detectable effect on groundwater degradation. And you know, the good news about the lead is it's also very dense, so it's prone to be staying down in those deep areas where we buried it. But it was an alternative to picking it up and hauling it off site and creating another disposal area. And we don't have a shortage of those in the Coeur d'Alene Basin because of the magnitude of the cleanup, but we also want to look to minimize that hauling and disposal when we can do it. In this case, it made sense to do so. And in case we just close up here, I do want to make sure we recognize Ann Daly. Ann actually would have presented this today, but she's not available. She was the lead project manager on this project. And I have to tell you, she was instrumental in bringing these people together and getting this project done. And she did it in a time when it was not an easy time to get work done, and not that it ever is. But I do think that the environment was particularly challenging in those days. And I think that the big nod needs to go to Ann. She's listed on this final slide, and I want to make sure we give her the proper accolades. And you know, if people have questions, I would recommend you contact her first, but I can also help you because I am in Region 10 and close the project out for Ann.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Ed, who's going to talk about considering native plants and pollinator habitats as part of our remediation and reuse of sites.
Thank you, Michelle. That was a very interesting project, and it's a nice scale, something fun to work with, I'm sure, as much as challenging. I'd like to go into talking about native plants, specifically pollinator habitats, and to cut to sort of the chase, as with any kind of ecological reuse or restoration projects, you need to determine what you want to achieve or target. This applies to ecological revitalization at contaminated sites as well. This could be restoring habitat that was impacted by the site, creating habitats that mirror adjacent ecological communities, or creating historical habitats that may now be uncommon in that region. I want to spend the next few minutes advocating for the use of native plants, specifically for the use of native plants and pollinator habitats. Why pollinator habitats? Well, probably the most compelling reason is for the ecosystem services that they provide, and specifically, and probably most obviously, their role in stemming the losses of pollinators that have been so, received so much press and attention, and rightly so. President Obama issued a memorandum in June of 2014 that recognized the role of pollinators to our economy and to our health. The memo presented a number of directives. The most relevant one to our, of this afternoon's discussion is the one that encourages the use of pollinator protection and habitat planning activities, incorporates this into green infrastructure and Superfund projects. That gives us the ability, it opens the door for us to be able to advocate for the use of pollinators and pollinator habitats. Now, while the directive clearly underscores the importance and the need for creating habitats, there are some very important practical benefits for providing these habitats. First of all, for the communities, there's a visual appeal. There's something about walking across or next to a meadow loaded with wildflowers or any other kind of pollinator habitat where once was a Superfund site or a contaminated site. It brings something out. It's kind of an enjoyable experience, especially for folks like a lot of us where these are the types of sites that we work on. There's the increased ecological services, the benefits to the community in terms of increased water quality, carbon sequestration, and of course pollination, as well as soil formation, nutrient cycling. There are recreational opportunities that are provided and enhanced by the provision of pollinator habitats. These can include bird watching, photography, enhances trail systems, so it really factors into both active and passive recreational uses. There's also benefits to agriculture. It helps assist in pollinator health and abundance in a region. There's studies that indicate that pollinator habitats actually enhance agricultural production. It increases fruit set, increases the weight of the fruit, get more mature seeds, higher crop yields. And there's the direct pollination services by the native pollinators, as well as control of insect pests or pets, if you happen to have those too, at your site. Site owners and PRPs benefit in a number of ways. It enhances how their site's viewed by the community. Perhaps it's turning what was once viewed as a liability, as an eyesore, into an asset for the community. Practically speaking, the creation of pollinator habitat can reduce maintenance and operation costs over the life of the site. It definitely reduces mowing frequency, reducing carbon footprint, and it can also reduce fertilization needs and pesticide use. One of the two sites I want to talk about specifically today is the Pollinator Meadows site at the DuPont Newport Superfund site. The site itself consists of two landfills. The Pollinator Meadows are located on the south landfill of the DuPont Newport site. The landfill is adjacent to the Christina River. The remedial activities at the site included the capping of the landfill, and the remedial construction was completed in 2002. So how did the project come to be? Well, DuPont likes to look at their properties and continually looks to putting their corporate lands to better use. They monitor reuse of their properties for habitat and to enhance that. They were a founding member of the Wildlife Habitat Council, and they partner with the Wildlife Habitat Council. They have several other projects at this site as well. So when they're looking at this particular site, this parcel, and brainstorming ideas, they realize that they can put the site to good use by helping to address pollinator issues in general. And in developing the project, they established their objective to increase pollinator diversity. When scoping the project, they identified three meadows that they would create, totaling a total of approximately half an acre. The meadows occupy different locations in the existing landscape, representing an upland area, an area adjacent to the river, and an area near a wetland area. These different positions in the landscape help to create some diversity and attract different array of pollinator species. They had the opportunity at this particular site to start with a relatively blank slate. They were looking at converting the existing landfill cover material, primarily grasses. During the planning and implementation stage, one of the first things that you need to do is to determine based on the location, the subtleties, the microtopography, and the existing habitat, what species you can and should plant. You need to evaluate the site conditions and plant what's best suited to the site. The folks at DuPont, they worked with their a local nursery, local plant supplier, as well as a seed supplier to ensure that what they planted was appropriate and applicable to the site, as well as maximize the use of pollinators at the site. They determined a planting strategy and how they were going to actually physically get the desired species there. And in this particular case, what they did was a combination of broadcast seeding as well as planting 800 individual plugs and plants. And in preparation of the site for the planting, as I said, it was existing landfill cover, they physically removed that existing vegetation. During the establishment and initial maintenance periods, they made sure that the property was watered as necessary. For invasives control, which is key on any restoration site, particularly one where you're dealing with trying to establish specific target vegetation, such as natives for a pollinator garden or pollinator habitat, you need to approach that with multiple tools. In this particular case, what DuPont did was they utilized target mowing, herbicide wick application, manual removal of undesirable plants, as well as seed head removal. After everything was established and growing, they monitored and continue to monitor plant success and the use by pollinators. Specifically, they're looking at survival and growth of the different plants that are there and the types and abundance of the pollinator species that are visiting the area. One of the neat features that I think they're doing here is they are actively collecting some of the seeds there, and they have used the seeds, distributed it to some of the volunteers as part of a thank you, and they're also going to be using the seeds to help reseed other areas that are targeted for restoration and reuse as pollinator areas. One of the things that I really thought was very cool with the way they approached this project was their involvement of the public, their employees, and the educational opportunities that they took advantage of here. One of the things that they did is they had an Earth Day lunch and learn, which I wish I would have thought of this myself, especially about 3 weeks ago, because it would have been a great thing to do to help assist with our planting that we do at our sites. But what they do is they use the Earth Day lunch and learn to help recruit volunteers to plant. They educated their employees what they were doing, and they were able to get volunteers out to assist. They had volunteer planting days where the folks came out and helped plant those 800 plugs. They had a monarch meadow watch to help educate the employees, show them what they were able to do, what they actually helped, had a part of creating. They followed up with all of this with thank you cards to the volunteers, and they included a photo of the meadow and seeds from the plants that were collected. And they planned on having a seed collection field day to help further collect seeds for those other sites. So it's some really neat ideas to involve and educate their employees. And I will close on this particular site with just a few of the individuals that are now at home here at the site at in Newport. So they've experienced quite a bit of success and done a wonderful job in attracting a nice array of different pollinator species. The next site I want to discuss is the Billred Asbestos Superfund site. The portion I want to talk about is a removal action at this point. This is a little bit different in that the site was targeted as a removal And I was brought in, and I'll give you a quick discussion, show you. This is the location of the site. The reservoir in the middle bifurcates the two portions. On the right side is the forested area, and that includes a small two-acre site, asbestos pile. This is a former park that is also an asbestos disposal area. I was brought in as they were clearing and getting ready to regrade the site of one pile along the Wissahickon Creek, which runs south or west of the site. They were looking at ways to restore the site and ensure that it would be properly revegetated while providing some habitat quality. What you'll see is that it was backfilled with in the back here, those geocells on top of geotextile with the soil. They armored, riprapped the bottom to ensure that that doesn't get torn up in storms. What we did is we recommended native seeds with pollinator species in there for habitat. And you'll see a few slides here as throughout the season, the first growing season actually, and the mix that was chosen had a great variety of very colorful flowers that picked up right away for the public. This is right next to a relatively large township in southeastern Pennsylvania. So the wow factor here was pretty pretty impressive, very colorful. So it really brought a lot of people and a lot of interest. And as you can see, this site was worked in phases. While this was already completely restored, they're still working on this other portion in a less critical time phase there. This photo shows some of the woody species that naturally recolonized within the riprap at the base of the slope adjacent to the creek. Now, the primary reason why I included this was one to show you that we do have desires to make sure that we help restore some of that riparian quarter, but not to the point where we're going to negatively potentially impact the stability of the slope in the future. But the other thing that's really clear and important here is to show that pollinator habitat isn't just what you plant. It's not just flowers. It includes woody species. It includes shrubs. You have to consider when you're planting this out the nature of the substrates. Make sure, depending on the species you want, whether or not you have sandy soils in places, bare soil where you can. So it involves more than just picking flowers and planting flowers. The other portion of the site is that wooded site. It was trees on top of open asbestos mixed with soil. It required the removal of the trees, the excavation of portions of the asbestos containing material, and the capping. And you can see this is in the final phases of capping of that area. And this is what the site looks like now. Same site, different view in the fall of the same year. So in closing, what I want to point out is the top challenges that we continually face when working these sites. First is the need for public education. The initial reaction is, wow, we've got weeds here. Well, they're not weeds. They may look like weeds, but realistically, they're wildflowers. The other thing is to manage expectations. People, first couple years, they may not see much of anything, especially if you're doing like a warm season grass planting, where it may take up to 3 years for mature plants to really be evident and to produce seeds. First year, that's very low growing. Most of the energy goes to root production. So it may not appear as things are happening the way they should. The big issue that we run into an awful lot is the soil material that's used. It's important to determine the agronomic properties of the soils. You have to make sure that the soil is clean, it's not contaminated, that it's not going to present an ecological risk in and of itself. The other big thing is to watch for compaction. You have a lot of heavy equipment moving around, and quite frankly, the tendency in a lot of cases of guys operating some of the equipment is you need to compact the soils to ensure that it's not going to move. Well, if you overly compact it, you're not going to be able to get a lot of the plants growing. There's also a question of why you may not be getting certain species coming in. Part of that has to do, with not properly matching the habitat with the conditions that you've got. And then, as I referred to before, you have the issue of invasives that have to be controlled on the site. The other big thing is timing when you're planning out the project. Whether or not you're doing it in the spring, the middle of the summer, it's important to make sure that you're able to control and deal with the rainfall issues and watering. Timing from a planting perspective is important to make sure you have the temperatures right. Are you doing cool season grasses, warm season grasses? Are you doing primarily forbs? The timing in terms of the availability of your planting materials, trees, shrubs, plants, whatever way you're going to go, there's an optimal time period for planting and when they become available, which leads us to whether or not you've got local supplies. The ideal situation is to make sure that you are utilizing plants with local provenance. One of the local seed catalogs that I looked at has summed it up best. The best habitats for native pollinators are provided by plants native to ecosystems from which they came. So you'll want to get local. You want to be local. And finally, maintenance. You want to make sure you specify exactly what you need. Educate people. Let people know why you're doing certain things. Why you only cut to 8 inches above if you're doing warm season grasses and forbs. Why you only want to cut on average once every 3 years in a warm season grass planting. And if necessary, if it comes down to it, if you need to really maintain control, you may have to make sure you put requirements in and not just suggestions. So in closing, I would like to thank Marianne Nicholson from the Chemours Corporate Mediation Group for all of her help in providing the information describing DuPont's pollinator meadows. And with that, I turn it back over to Michelle.
Great. Thank you, Ruth. I think in the interest of time, maybe we'll take one question now. And if we have any time at the end, we'll address some of the other questions. One participant was curious about, I guess prior to doing the seeding, was there any capping material used on these sites?
At the DuPont site, that site was capped and covered with clean soil, obviously, and it was revegetated in preparation for the seeding. The vegetative layer was removed, the vegetation was removed, and that was seeded in the existing soil. For the Bowritt site, that cover material, it was not capped per se in that area, but it was soil that was brought onto the site, which led to the comment about making sure you know the agronomic properties, the chemical right. properties of that soil you're bringing in.
Right, right. One more question I'll just ask. Can you talk about any of the plant species that were used at the Ambler site?
Yeah, the Ambler site, that specifically we relied on, two things. For the landfill itself, the waste pile, we utilized what the supplier calls a native wildflower and grass mix. That includes things like little blue stem, side oats, grama, Indian grass, partridge pea, black-eyed Susan, wild senna, milkweed, wild bergamot. New England aster, oxeye sunflower. So it's a combination of about 20 different species,
right.
which you know, I'm glad you asked that, because it's important to point out that with a lot of the mixes, we try to make sure we utilize mixes that have a wide array of species. so that they can tolerate different conditions. And nature will help select what's there. The other thing is for different moisture regimes, such as on that steep slope. Towards the bottom, we utilized more of a riparian quarter kind of mix that was more adapted to wetter conditions, whereas towards the top, we use more of a steep slope mix in some of the areas to ensure that we had good holding power and control of erosion. And in different areas where it's not as steep, we would overlap an upland and a riparian mix to make sure in that transition zone in moisture where you might not know exactly how it's going to go, you've got that overlap. So different species will come in different years. And some years it might be dominant and others it won't. So high number of species and overlap.
Patient Bruce, it was really informative. Now we're going to move on to our next speaker, who's Jeff Field, who's from our EPA Region 7 office, who's going to talk about another case study at the Chemical Commodities Incorporated site. And we'll get to hear about some really impressive work they've done there.
Hey, thanks, Michelle. This is Jeff. Bruce, I got to tell you, that's your presentation is a perfect segue and covers a lot of the specific details that factored into the chemical commodity site. And I'll touch on some of those as we go through here. So I'll be talking about the Chemical Commodities Incorporated site. We refer it to as CCI for short, and this is a short history cleanup and ecological reuse of a Superfund site. And as you can see here, the site boundaries of CCI, it's located in Olathe, Kansas. It's a site of approximately 1.5 acres adjoining the railroad right-of-way that you can see to the right of the site. And you can see that this is a really, really intensive residential area. It's a very old section of Olathe, and the homes have been there since the early 50s, late 40s. Excuse me. The contamination on the site has moved off-site, and the primary preferential flow pathways of groundwater is to the west and has impacted many of these homes in this area here. It's impacted homes to the degree that we've had to install vapor mitigation systems in approximately 48 homes. You can see that the site is a mix of light commercial, light industrial, along with residential areas. That's a pretty good Google shot there that we're looking at now. The site itself was when it was in operation, was a chemical brokerage facility that collected hazardous chemicals and was supposed to be processed for reuse and repackaging. However, the best laid plans sometimes go awry, and you can see here some of the site pictures from the late 70s. Indicate, for lack of a better term, some poor housekeeping and some other activities occurred to where it created some substantial problems. There are all types of chemicals stored on the site in various types of containers. You can see there are above-ground storage tanks, and in the foreground, maybe in the middle of the picture, you can see a tanker truck that was full of chemicals. The buildings on site were full of chemicals. Various and sundry TCE, PCE, we found picric acid, pharmaceuticals. It was an incredible mess. And a lot of these things were leaking, rusting, and causing some serious problems. Explosions, fires, over a course of 10 years, there were a number of fires that had to be responded to by the local fire department with explosions. And looking at these pictures, you can see they're taken at an elevation. These pictures were taken by a ladder truck, firemen up on the ladder truck for the Olathe Fire Department, who had responded to a number of these fires. This is an interesting photograph here in the sense that if you look up here to the top left, you can see that there's a fence and there are homes right there, right adjoining this basically an ecological environmental disaster. Yeah, thanks. There's a cursor right along here. Based on all the fires, and this is another picture of the whole site and the buildings and everything like that, so it was quite a mess, as you can see, and the railroad's in the back, and there's some other light industrial complexes also in the back that were not contributed to the contamination in the area. The facility operated up until 1989 and ultimately went bankrupt. However, you know, response to the fires, small explosions, they had material, neighborhood residents, you know, saw materials leaving the site, flowing off site, killing grasses and things like that. Finally, you know, with all the complaints piling up, the state of Kansas and the city of Olathe started conducting inspections on site, and we were brought in later in the game to start dealing with the site. We did approximately, let's see, we listed the site at 94 in the NPL, and we had done, from the listing, we had done probably 5 non-time critical removal actions of various types, dealing with categorizing the prioritizing and classifying the contaminants, doing loadouts and sending them off to the proper disposal facilities. We did a number of excavations on site of surface soils that were highly contaminated with solvents and heavy metals. And we had, you know, we basically tore down all the buildings on the site and removed everything to where the only thing that was left on site were the foundations of all the buildings that were on there. In 2004, after a very, very extensive site characterization by the performing settling defendant, which was the Boeing company, there were, I believe, a dozen other defendants in the case, and they had worked it out that Boeing would be the settling performing defendant, and you know, a lot of kudos go to them, not only for taking over the site and doing the remedy, but in doing the next steps, what I'll be covering here. In 2004, we did a proposed plan to the community in a public meeting. We sent it out, and KDHE and EPA met with the local citizens, you know, at the public meeting like we do. Then subsequently rolled out a feasibility study, which really didn't quite pass muster with the local community, so we went back and revisited the proposed or selected remedy we had in the proposed plan, which ultimately was included these alternatives here. For soils, we did excavation off-site disposal, the construction of a soil cap, and when I say soil cap, it's not a soil cap in the strict sense of a Subtitle D RCRA type cap over a landfill or an UMTRCA type cap. This is just a cap in which they, you know, had several layers of crushed rock, a couple of feet of backfill, compacted down to 95% proctor, geotextile laid over it, and then a top cap of over a foot of nice clean soil that we were obtained from a borrow pit from a local farmer. Of course, we had the soil tested as required, and it was very clean, very good soil. And this gentleman was using it to grow corn, so we knew it was a viable media to use for growing what we thought was going to be just a green space. Of course, institutional controls, and we addressed groundwater under the G2 alternative using Chemox. They continue to do Chemox injections at the site in different forms or different methods of putting the Chemox in the ground. They're seeing really, really good destruction of VOCs on site with the Chemox. And the last thing we added is the additional excavation and treatment components to further enhance the on-site source area treatment. So that's something that we adjusted according to, you know, feedback from the local citizenry and the need to clean this up to how they felt it should be cleaned up and utilized further on. Shortly after we, you know, had the proposed plan and we adjusted the proposed plan accordingly, discussions in earnest with EPA, the state of Kansas, and the local CAG group that had just formed, you know, we asked them, what is it that you want this site to ultimately look like? And as you can see from the previous pictures that, you know, it was to say it was an eyesore is a serious understatement. So we went and had several CAG meetings and several discussions back and forth, and ultimately they decided overwhelmingly that what they wanted was just a green space, just green grass, some trees, an area where the local kids can go out and kick a soccer ball, some place that was safe, that was, you know, something that the community could utilize. And so we moved forward on that. We approached the city of Olathe, and they changed the zoning specific to green space, which what they have. There will be no residential units built on there. It will not be changed into light industrial or any type of, it's going to stay green space, and it'll always run with the lay of the land. So the green space is what we all agreed to, and that's what was factored into to the ultimate remedial action. And we started on-site construction activities in May of 2011 to implement this remedy. This is kind of a chronology, I think, from Google Shots. Thank you, Google, for the ability to have that. And you can see the early photographs I showed you from circa 1970. And on the April 2011, you can see the foundations left on site. Let's see, I lost my cursor. Right around here, you can see the foundations left on site. This is the ingress and egress from the site on the cul-de-sac. I'd like to point out these homes right here. There were six homes located here that you can see are not there anymore. Boeing bought out these residences in a very generous package, not because of risk or anything like that, but because of the implementability of bringing the cap, if you will, that was being contemplated and designed on site, bringing it into a way here that makes the flow of the land and the topography very smooth and amenable to, you know, plane. There's no drop-offs and things like that. So this land here, again, was purchased by Boeing under a open space, it was a limited LLC that they did, and they still own this land here. Okay. This, as we proceeded down into this picture here from August 2011, is that we had finished basically all the remedial activities that I described earlier way ahead of time. They had good subcontractors, good contractors, and Boeing didn't spare any expense in making this happen. So what you see here is basically the cap has been put in place, and this is a material called Cerelex, which is like a Excelsior-type material. They overseeded it with a low-mow grass to cut down on O&M costs for mowing. And this was a biodegradable type of grass or cover that the grass was able to grow up between it, and it worked really well. As you can see down here in the September 2012 overflight, there's some beginning of the pollinator gardens. But this is right here, the restored, this one right here, was what the community ultimately wanted from their early decision. They wanted a green space. And when the grass came up and it looked like it, as you see here, I mean, they were just tickled pink. I mean, this was something that, you know, didn't think would actually happen. You know, when somebody shows up, you know, as we are, that we're from the government, we're here to help, sometimes it gets missed in interpretation. But we did put something in place that was really good for the community. Much to Boeing's credit, they approached us here at the regional office early on, not long after this restored site was picture was taken, and indicated to us that they were willing to go above and beyond you know, the consent decree, which they fulfilled with flying colors, they wanted to go above and beyond this green space and put something in place that would benefit not only the community around the site, but also benefit the community at large in the city of Olathe, and it's proved to do that. They had heard of Chip Taylor, who is the founder and is still a critical component. He's a professor of biology at the University of Kansas. And he founded Monarch Watch, which is an incredible entity that does a lot of work in putting in monarch way stations, if you will, or these types of facilities to enhance or to bring back the types of habitats needed for monarch migration. This location in Kansas is almost slap dab in the middle of the migration pathway of monarchs as they migrate yearly up north, down south, and back and forth. So, you know, we identified, we had these conversations, we went to the CAG, we did the presentation of what Boeing wanted to do, and, you know, they were pretty incredulous that this was going to happen. We contacted Monarch Watch and other entities, the Pollinator Partnership, the Wildlife Habitat Council that was mentioned earlier. There were a number of other entities out there. I'm trying to think what they were. I can't think of what they are. Got them listed further on. But when you tap into these entities, they have a network that's already existing in place of these incredible players that are so excited and so dedicated in putting this type of site in place here that it was just an incredible job that they had done. As you can see here, let me get this is a concrete path, a walking path that was put in place. These four linear objects here were plantings for native plants, as Bruce mentioned earlier, in grasses and forbs that are critical for developing pollinator-type habitats. Each of these four ovals that you see here are beds dedicated to birds, bees, butterflies, and monarchs individually. So each one of these addresses a particular type of pollinator, and the plants that were selected by a local entity called Applied Ecological Services worked with Monarch Watch, the Pollinator Partnership, again, which is a critical player in helping us identify the proper types of plants to utilize for each of these four beds, and Applied Ecological Services in being able to procure these plants from their extensive resources and to actually come out and help us put these plants in place. So we've always...
Sorry to interrupt, Jeff. This is Jean. Just letting you know you've got about 1 to 2 minutes left.
Okay, no problem. So next one here. We started. Here's the gardens in early September. And in May of 2013, we had a planting day that we put out on social media looking for volunteers. We had approximately 100 people show up, kids, adults, master gardeners. And they were master gardeners dedicated to each bed that would guide the volunteers in doing the proper plantings. This is in late June 2013. You can see the beds are in early formation here with the concrete pathway to the back. And I would point out these kiosks here that are every bed, point out what type of pollinators that they're focused on in the bed. And there's a QR that you can scan with your iPhone that gives each person that does that the list of plants that are inside the garden. So if they want to take that information home and do their own types of plantings to increase the pollinator habitats, not just for monarchs. This is kind of like what Bruce had shown earlier, the types of vegetation that we put in to the beds. It's very good. We have a volunteer group of master gardeners, about a dozen of them, that go out there. Matter of fact, they were out there Monday prepping the beds, doing some pruning and weeding, manual weeding for the springtime and summer growth. They're out there now. And that's it. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I know that was quick, but it was a kind of a brief snapshot of, you know, the need to do these types of habitat rehabilitations, if you will, particularly in these urban type, suburban type areas.
All right. Yeah. Interested and willing to go above and beyond. We had gotten a question about that, so I was glad that you had mentioned that. I think in the interest of time, we're going to try to get through our next two presentations, and then if we have any time left, we'll address any additional questions that come in. So our next presenter is Mary Byrne, who is with the Pollinator Partnership, and she's going to talk to us about some of the resources and what they do. Hi, Mary, you might need to take yourself off mute.
Hello, this is Mary Byrne from the Pollinator Partnership. Can you hear me now?
Yes, you sound loud and clear.
Okay,
thank
great.
You.
Okay, terrific. Well, Bruce and Jeff, thank you so much for setting the stage perfectly for what I'm about to talk about. The Pollinator Partnership is the world's largest organization dedicated exclusively to the conservation, research, education, and preservation of pollinators. I work as the plant ecologist for P2. We have active projects throughout the U.S. and Canada. We also have some other smaller projects in other parts of the world. The Pollinator Partnership's mission is to promote the health of pollinators, which of course are critical to our food and ecosystem through conservation, education, and research. And you can see here a variety of our different initiatives. We have a school garden kit where we work with children. The Pollinator Week, National Pollinator Week, which some of you may have heard about, is one of our big initiatives. We work in cross-corporate landscapes like utility rights of way and are always looking for new partners to promote pollinators, either through education outreach or do on-the-ground restoration work. We were involved, as Jeff said, in the Pollinator Prairie, the former CCI site. We helped select plants, work closely with CHIP, and develop the interpretive signage throughout the site. And we also work in other sites like the former coal power plant, Hunters Point, which is owned by PG&E. This site, we did some restoration and some monitoring, and also prepared the Wildlife Habitat Council wildlife at work application package. So, for a lot of our sites, we could do the consulting and technical work, but then also how do we promote that site and use it as an example to others who are interested in planting for pollinators or at least inviting them on their site. We have a new initiative called Monarch Wings Across Ohio, where we're taking sites like corporate gardens, farms, urban lands, basically sites that may be degraded, may have another land management objective, and seeing how we could develop habitat guidance for these various scenarios. So you can see here, we've got a vacant lot in Cleveland, and then we have a First Energy right-of-way that runs through the Cleveland Metro Park. We offer guidance to anybody that we work with. We really try to meet people where they're at. So when we develop monarch habitat guidance for utility rights of way, we want to do a technically site-specific or site-type-specific information for them, same with corporate lands. And we're hoping to roll the urban lands and farming technical guides out soon. We also have general eco-regional planting guides. If you go to our website, you could simply plug in your zip code and receive a list of plants that are native to your ecoregion that are all pollinator friendly. You could also download the full, I believe, like 30-page guide if you'd like to print it out and use it for reference. We just recently published our first two guides for Canada, and then we have guides for across the continuous United States as well as Hawaii. We also have a series of brochures, again, really trying to meet people where they're at. We get a ton of questions about bees and getting stung, and, you know, a lot of people do want to help pollinators, but they're concerned about stings. So we have a no-fear sting brochure. We have a brochure that speaks directly to energy rights of way and integrative vegetation management strategies. We have also a series of guides that are faith-based initiatives. So, looking for opportunities to plant for pollinators across the faith-based communities. We work with schools. We developed a standard a curriculum for pollinators. It's tied to the California state standards. Just trying to engage children in different pollinator activities. A lot of the sites that we've worked with to do restoration work have used pieces and parts of the Be Smart School Garden Kit to educate children on site. There's about 10 lesson plans with activities. We know full well that teachers are really busy, and even though they might want to incorporate pollinators into their curriculum, it's difficult to come up with whole new lesson plans to do that. So that's why we created the School Garden Kit. And we also have the Be Smart app. So not only if you show up at the CCI site in Kansas and scan the QR code, you'll get a list of plants on site. You could also plug in your zip code on the free Be Smart Pollinator Garden app and get a list of pollinator-friendly plants that are native to that zip code. You could tag off and select your favorite plants. You could also select plants by the type of pollinator that you'd like to attract. And if I can move the green pointer, you could see here, you could filter down. If you'd only like plants that attract bees, you could select that, or butterflies. Of course, a lot of times, butterflies and bees don't really talk about who gets which plant, so there's a lot of overlap there. But there's all sorts of site-specific selections you can make, from the sun availability to the soil type. And one of our big initiatives is called SHARE, simply having areas reserved for the environment. Our goal is to enroll 1 million acres across any landscape type, Superfund sites, utilities, ranches, farms, schools, backyard gardeners, anybody that is taking a minute to plant for pollinators and keep the environment in mind when they're managing their landscape. It could be a share site, could be as simple as a potted area on a city balcony, or a 1,000-acre Bureau of Land Management tract. So we're inviting anybody on this webinar to sign up your site. Others would love to know what you're doing for pollinators. There's a lot of technology transfer that could still happen. There's a lot of lessons to be learned across different partners. So we feel like SHARE is one of those places where we're not only sharing space for the environment, but we're also sharing best practices. So that's a brief overview of the pollinator partnership. Information that we have available to others. Most all of it is free. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them now. And you're more than welcome to email me or give me a call if you would like to talk about your specific site and doing pollinator-friendly practices on your site.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mary, very much. These resources you have are really, really great. And I know we've used them at EPA in many instances, trying to educate particularly children about pollinators. I think we'll move on to our next presentation, and then if we have any time left, we'll pause for some questions. So I want to introduce our last presenter, Damon Frizzell, who's going to talk about some work that they're doing in Region 7 with their pollinator protection work group actions.
Well, thank you very much. My name is Damon Frizzell, and I work as the Ag Advisor here in the region, but I've also over the last several years been active and just acting as a coordinator for many of the pollinator activities. And so I just wanted to give you a brief overview of what we're doing in terms of the work group actions and developing a strategy within Region 7. And hopefully our intent is to make you aware of what we have here and maybe encourage you to develop something similar within your regions. And we're more than happy to work with you to provide you a copy of what we have. So I'll go ahead and get started here. Like I said, we've been doing some things for several years, in particular with the Iowa State University and the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship. They actually developed an initiative there in Iowa, in part with headquarters, and we got many other stakeholders involved, including the Xerces Society and NRCS, as well as the Iowa Department of Environmental Quality. And from that, we really focused a lot on outreach and education to individuals, letting them know what the issues were, also on training. We have, within our pesticide programs in all four states, we have the certification and training programs, and so adapting a lot of the materials within the enforcement program so that those individuals would be familiar with many of the things that we're doing in pollinator protection, the different types of BMPs, the registries that we have in many of our states that will help them, and just kind of looking at federal and state regulations as well. So all of those things kind of gave us a little bit of a head start on many of the things that we're doing here now. All right, I want to talk next a little bit, just give you an overview of our purpose and our vision of the strategy we've developed. First of all, our purpose is to identify and really just put into practice pollinator protection through our existing regional programs, just identifying what those programs might do that maybe we haven't been taking advantage of. So our vision is to enhance pollinator health and the habitat within Region 7 by kind of weaving all these political or pollinator considerations into our everyday activities. All right, with that, talk about the work group actions specifically. Following the President's memorandum that we talked about a little bit earlier, Bruce had mentioned, our regional administrator, Carl Brooks, at the time, he thought that it would be helpful to pull together a work group and identify a regional strategy that we could put in place before the national strategy was even developed. So that's what we're doing. We're finalizing that right now. And we've really kind of narrowed it down. We've got 11 members actually in this regional work group from many of our different programs that we thought might have some potential to have some sort of an impact on pollinator issues. And you can see here the Superfund division, of course, the remedial projects, one that Jeff has just talked about is one good example. They also can work with ecological revitalization in our water, wetlands, and pesticides division. We have the pesticide program that's working directly with headquarters on pesticidal issues, and in that we're looking and to work with our state lead agencies and our tribes to develop habitat and address enforcement issues with the pesticides themselves. We also have our wetlands remediation projects that we're looking to see if we can incorporate some habitat into our non-point source programs or funding BMPs, so encouraging pollinator practices. We have many permitting type activities that we might be able to incorporate pollinator habitat into, as well as green infrastructure projects. In our air and waste management division, which includes RCRA, of course, we've got the landfill management and remediation projects in there as well. We also think that through our PLMG, or Office of Policy and Management, we can hopefully develop a facility site plan, and I'll talk to you a little bit more about that here in a minute. And we also have a few other programs that are involved as well, but those are the primary ones that I wanted to mention. Okay, on to the next here. Our regional work group, we actually broke it down into three specific initiatives. It started out bigger than that, but we kind of consolidated. And so these were the three primary ones that we've really got teams working on. Outreach, education, and partnership is our first one. Here we're identifying our potential new partnerships, you know, including state, federal, and local agencies. We also have many universities, educational institutions, and industry themselves. We are trying to target audiences through this that are best suited to help us meet our strategy goals. We're also focusing on what the message will be in our outreach and educational events. We want to start with the decline of the pollinators, address the causes of the decline, what are the environmental and economic benefits of pollinators. We want to identify the different types of plants and types of habitat that are beneficial to pollinators. And then last of all, we want to identify our many BMPs, or best management practices, that effectively identify ways to reduce harmful effects of the pesticides themselves and for developing or protecting pollinator habitat. So that's our main focus within the Outreach Education Partnerships Initiative. Then we have our second one is Facilities Initiative. Within this, we're really trying to identify what efforts we can do to protect and expand our pollinator community here at our work site. Some of the specific actions that I'm referring to include like a baseline inventory, work with GSA and our facility owner to really identify what practices they may let us incorporate. And from this, we'll try to develop an action plan that consists of identifying beneficial plants and other types of structures for nesting or hives, what types of maintenance will be handled by the contractors versus volunteers. But we really want to use this more than just an area for pollinators. We want to also use it as a demonstration area so that when we're having outreach and education events, we can train individuals on how to plant and incorporate these into other sites. And we want to also involve many volunteers, you know, employees, contractors, and others. So those are some of the things that we're planning on doing with the facility. And then last of all, our third initiative is on internal programs. And the internal programs, that's really how we got started with the project that you just heard about from Jeff Field. Although his project was done well before the strategy started, they've already started looking at ways they can utilize that project in developing a guide for others to follow, developing training that can be broke down, kind of a basic training to show all of our Superfund project managers how to incorporate pollinator habitat, what the resources are, and so on. And so that's the plan here in the near future. We've also identified many other areas, as I kind of mentioned earlier, including RCRA, landfill sites. We've also identified our enforcement program. We want to identify steps that might be able to be developed to encourage others to develop habitat in those or other types of beneficial pollinator programs. And there are also other areas that we believe that we can incorporate some beneficial programs into, such as some of our grant and contract incentives, the permits, tribal partnerships, and many others. So that's what we're in effect starting out. And if anyone is interested, I certainly encourage you to give me a call, and I'd be glad to send you a copy of our draft strategy that's just about, hopefully, to be approved. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you so much, Damon. Yeah, I think you sort of answered the question that we had. Someone wanted to know, I guess, more of just local groups that they were looking to partner with, you know, federal agencies to support the development of habitats as part of these projects. How would they would get in touch? It seems maybe they should get in touch with you if they want to become part of this project that you mentioned.
Yeah, I'd certainly be willing to help work with them and identify how we're doing it here in the region and see if I could help them.
Great. I think I'll definitely be in touch with you about how to maybe take what you guys are doing and incorporate it into other regional projects.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. As you can see, Gene has pulled up a survey that we have about future topics that you'd like to see on our Superfund redevelopment webinars. So we'll keep this up here for another second. I did have one question. Mary, if you're still on the line, we have a question that came in that can you talk about any common misconceptions that you've seen regarding pollinators or pollinator habitats?
Yeah, sure. I guess the biggest common misconception is just a fear of bees. You know, attracting bees to your site, fewer people get stung and die of bee stings every year than get struck by lightning. If anybody is concerned about getting stung by bees, I encourage them to read our brochure. You know, bees are out foraging for their own food and resources. They're not very, you know, they're not really flying around to sting people, and I guess it's just, you know, a big educational piece and opportunity to overcome. So that's the biggest misconception.
Yeah, I could believe that. Thank you. Well, I think we've come to the end of our session here. I want to thank all of our presenters. We had some really excellent presentations and some good participation from the audience, and I really want to thank you. I think all of your presentations really flowed into each other very well, and I think it's a great resource to have archived for the future, and we're doing a lot more of this in Superfund sites, and I hope that we'll have a lot more webinars talking about more sites that are incorporating this type of practice. So with that, maybe we'll leave the survey up for another 2 seconds or so, and Gene, if you want to take us into our conclusion for the webinar and letting people know how they can get more information about all the other great topics that we present as part of this CLUIN.org.
Absolutely. I see just a few more people are typing some things up, so I do apologize if you are in mid-type. I am about to click a button and switch us over to the other layout. If you didn't have a chance to share your specific webinar suggestions or add your email address to that list, you can certainly share that information with us in your feedback form, which I'll direct everybody to at the end. So I just wanted to remind everybody that this webinar was part of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar series. We have been hosting webinars as part of that series on CLUIN for several years. We have 24 archived webinars that you can currently get to from the following website, and we'll continue on with the series throughout this particular calendar year. So again, we welcome your input on future topics. For those of you that are looking for copies of the presentation materials, as well as other websites and resources, again, they're all highlighted under the related URLs in the middle box on the right, but we've also stored them online from the seminar links page or resources page off the seminar homepage. Sometimes people need copies of these materials to help document their attendance, so if you're looking for them, you'll find them there. That also applies for those of you who are replaying the archived version of today's webinar. You can still access the materials from that link. I would ask each of you, if you could, to take a moment and fill out the short online feedback form. I do read each and every one of your replies. We had just over 210 people who participated in today's live broadcast, so I'd love to hear your thoughts. Each time you fill out the feedback form, there is a box you can check. Many people ask us for seminar certificates. We are testing the tool, but right now we don't offer certificates for every webinar. However, if you share feedback, there is a box you can check on the online feedback form. As long as your email address is entered correctly and you check that box, it gives you an automated confirmation email message that does document you submitted feedback after the live delivery. You can fill out as many of those forms as you need, so if you shared the line with multiple people, each person can fill out their own feedback form and each get their own confirmation email. If you are watching the recorded version, you can still follow the links to the seminar feedback form and share your thoughts through that page. And as I noted, if you missed out on the chance to share your thoughts about future webinar topics, you'll find that's there. You can share that in the comment section on our feedback form. And again, if you want to learn about future webinars or other information resources, you can certainly visit the Kluwen website or connect with us on popular social and professional networking sites. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have today, so I'm going to go ahead and conclude today's live broadcast. I want to send my thanks to Michelle, our support staff from SCIO, as well as all of our presenters who joined us from a variety of organizations here across the country. I hope that, again, the 210 participants who joined us today live found today to be an informative session and that we'll either see